Hello, everyone, and welcome to the first episode of the Gravel Junction podcast, your meeting place for all things bike, adventure, and the stories that follow. I'm your host, Charles Detmer. Yes, yes, finally, first episode of the Gravel Junction podcast is out, is live. So good to have all you wonderful listeners tuning in, and hopefully you will enjoy the many wonderful episodes to follow. When planning for the show began, we started by creating a list of people we would like to talk to, people that really represent what it is we're trying to do here at the Gravel Junction. So what are we trying to do here? Well, let's start with the name, Gravel Junction. You say gravel, we think outside, we think adventure, we think nature. Pretty good start. And junction, well, a junction is a meeting place, a crossing of paths, if you will. That is what we are looking to create with this show, a platform from which to share, enjoy, and learn from the experiences of the amazing bike riding community. Community being the key word, a community that we want to grow, because the more people out there riding bikes and interacting with their surroundings, the better the world we live in will be. We have a great first show for you today, and to kick things off, who better to talk to than Mr. Kevin Benkenstein, aka Benki. Well known to the South African cycling community, Benki is a powerful, unassuming weapon on the bike, and an absolute gentleman and role model off the bike. A true spokesperson for all that is good about riding a bike. We sat down with Kevin to unpack his latest victory in the Munga mountain bike race, as well as a host of other topics, including the growing gravel bike scene in South Africa and the need to get some of our talented gravel and ultra-endurance cyclists overseas to show their stuff. So without further ado, sit back and enjoy our chat with Benki. Welcome to the Gravel Junction podcast, mate. Thank you for taking the time to sit down with us and having a bit of a chat.
No stress. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Listeners may or may not know, you recently relocated back to the Midlands. Is that right? From Cape Town?
Yeah, that's correct. I grew up in KZN in the Midlands, and we moved to Cape Town for my wife's work, and then lockdowns, et cetera, happened, and remote work. So then she was in a position where she could live in a smaller town and not have to live and work in a big city. So we took the opportunity in, I think, April, May, to move back here. So we've got a nice...
How's that going? How's that adjustment?
Yeah, it's good. It's easy for me. I mean, I just came home. So I just slotted into my old mates and most of my old riding and, you know, some new riding, because I'm lucky with the forest. You kind of always find new spots. Life's been good, and my wife loves the area. Michaela really enjoys the riding here and the quiet life. And I mean, I've got my chickens and my goose and my dogs, and yeah, not quite a farm, but I mean, it's nice. And for a little one, you know, a little two, it's a great place to raise kids. So that's kind of the main thing, really.
Yeah, I mean, following your social media and that, I mean, obviously a lot of gravel and off-road riding, it just seems the options out there are just incredible. Like, I haven't ridden out there personally, but it just seems endless options as far as the riding out there goes.
Yeah, we're really spoiled. I mean, I live across the road from a big forest, a whole bunch of plantations that have maybe 40 or 50 Ks of single track that you can do. And around that single track is obviously forest roads. And from my house, I mean, we've got 500K routes that we do, you know, so which are at least 80% gravel. And generally when it's not gravel, it's in very rural areas. So
what's the gravel like compared to the gravel we have here? Is it as corrugated down as we have in the Western Cape?
No. I mean, a little bit in winter, we get some corrugations, but generally brown tar. You know, sort of 40 mil tires are fantastic, which is maybe the best indication where the Cape you're looking for. Something with stronger sidewalls and bigger knobs and, like, sort of higher volumes. So Yeah, I mean, we've got a bit of everything, but generally the gravel roads are very well maintained. So you get away with a road type setup, faster bike.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, is that generally most of your training you're doing on the gravel stuff? Then you don't do too much road then, I suppose, even from a safety point of view.
In a normal year, I would say yes. This year we've had significant amounts of rain in the past 2 or 3 months. And so it kind of, the roads have been a bit of a mud bath unless it's a sunny day. So I've been on the road a bit more, but for the majority of last year, we were off-road. Just, yeah, I mean, like I say, I can do 100K loop from my front door where 90K is off-road. So it's really easy to just stay off-road. Yeah, that works really nicely for me. So I'm spoiled. And it's very, very hilly. And that's also really good. I mean, you know, I live at the top of a climb that's 8Ks long. So you get a nice 30 to 40 minute climb.
Getting home.
yeah. Or generally, everyone else lives at the bottom of the hill. So I generally ride down to them, ride straight back up it. And that's the first hour of my ride. And then we head off out into the farmlands. So, and I mean, just generally, it's not a flat place. So we get a lot of climbing, and I really enjoy that. I mean, that's what I grew up. I used to ride exclusively road when I was a teenager, and I was a very, very skinny, tall person. So I loved going up hills then. I'm now just a less skinny climber.
Less skinny, but still enjoy going up.
Yeah, I still love going up. So yeah, okay. I really enjoy it. And I mean, the top of the hill is always a good view, so it's worth it.
Exactly. Well, I suppose that leads, like talking about the climbing hills and all that, and the sort of training sort of leads me into the next thing, which is the event you won last year, the Munga, the AKA the world's toughest race. Just doing my research on this one, it seems like you have a bit of a soft spot for this race. I mean, just running through the results here, was 2016 your first attempted or first race, and the lowest you finished so far, I see, is fifth.
Yeah, so I did it in 2016. It was my first ultra. The first time that I'd really raced in a long distance stuff. I mean, I've done a lot of long rides, 200K stuff. Really thought I was very good at riding far. Had no idea what I was doing. Had the life beaten out of me in the first 400Ks. We actually had that was still probably the toughest edition of the race that I've done. It's just the first day was hellish with a 45 degree temperature and insane headwinds, and that really beat me. So yeah, that first year was a huge learning curve. I mean, I was just very happy to have finished. And then yeah, I think, you know, the nature of most of us is that you want to sort of master something. And so I keep being drawn back. I keep saying I'm never doing it again. And then somehow a month before, 2 weeks before, or 2 months before, I end up entering. And yeah, so it's been a work in progress for really the better part of 5 years. You know, learning about myself and how I ride and how to train or not train. Probably more important to learn how to not train with these things.
Yeah, I mean, could you elaborate a bit on that? Is that sort of, you know, we don't want to go into the super nerdiness of it, but are there like general trends that you've noticed that you've really have benefited your performance, that, you know, whether it's mental state or like less is more, as you say?
Yeah, I think it's just learning your body and learning to listen to your body. I think one of the tough things when you're not doing this as your job, you know, you're not a professional, then you still have other things that you have to do. And so you have other stresses in your life. And just learning to manage all of those different aspects together and getting better at that. But I think most of all, over the past year or so, actually, probably after getting COVID, funny enough, because I was forced to take a step back last December and really, like, I think for the first time I was off the bike for maybe 6 weeks, which is the longest I've had off the bike since I started riding again, 2012. And that forced me to start from zero. And because obviously recovering from COVID, you can't just go straight back into a 20-hour week because you'll put yourself into some proper difficulty. I was forced to operate on less. And that really, I noticed that the extra freshness allowed me to use the sort of residual fitness that I've got built up over the past 7 or 8 years and maintain my sort of my speed in the race for a little bit longer. So I did change my training quite a lot this year. Less volume, especially the least I've ridden, like our annual hours since 2012.
Yes, I saw that actually on your Instagram there, which surprised me.
Yeah, which sorry, it surprised me too. I mean, you know, I think we get it beaten into us that more is more. And I mean, I see the European ultra endurance riders have done significantly more riding than me this year. I haven't had the chance to race them, unfortunately. So I don't know if I am wrong, maybe, but I definitely felt a huge difference in that this year. I still did my distance stuff. I mean, I still, because I take the tour and whatever, you know, I did a few 6 or 7 hour days. But my general training was really like 2 to 4 hours. I'd 5 hour ride every so often when it allowed me. But with that said, there's a lot of consistency in that, you know. So, you know, it's not riding 2 to 4 hours 3 days a week. It's still 6 days a week. You know, so I sort of average 14, 16 hours a week. I think over the course of the year, most of my training weeks were that 14 to 16 hour week, with the odd easier week of, say, 12 hours. Just a little bit more focus when I was riding. But again, I ride with a group of mates who vary in ability. So, you know, we don't like destroy ourselves every ride. I mean, you know, you ride 4 hours and talk rubbish and have a laugh and abuse each other. And so you're not on the limit for 4 hours, but it's no fun being on the limit for 4 hours every Saturday. So it's just been about finding the mix that works better for me. And then, you know, and then when it comes to the interval sessions, which unfortunately have to happen, you know, just really, really listening to my body and working out, you know, these are the sessions that I enjoy, and so I can perform them properly. I don't do anything fancy, you know. I ride up and down a hill for an hour and a half and then go home and curl up in the fetal position and
eat everything in the fridge while still wearing your bibs.
exactly. I mean, but you know, for 90 minutes, just go all the way in. I don't do very many half-assed intervals anymore, which I think I used to. I'm just more confident in doing what I need to do. But I mean, it's not the intervals that you would do if you were doing Cape Epic or, you know, a normal 100, even 100 miler. I'd probably do different intervals. You know, it's a lot of 20 minutes and longer, which are extremely unpleasant, you know. So it's 20 minutes full gas or 45 minutes full gas or an hour full gas, and then you rest for 15 minutes and do that again. But that's what I found works for me. And
I guess like you say, it's very much, it's a marathon, not a sprint, right? For that, you, the type of riding you're doing at the moment.
Yeah, precisely. And I've got the feeling that, you know, you get a lot more benefit from doing like 3 really good days back to back than going for a 12-hour ride and not being able to operate for 5 days. Because, you know, it's almost impossible to ride for 12 hours and be good 3 or 4 days later. So
you depleted, haven't you? You've got into your reserves and you've just asked a lot of your body to then function the next day.
Precisely. And I think that's regardless of how hard you go for those 12 hours, I think 12 hours riding a bike is difficult. It doesn't matter if you ride full gas or moderate or easy. 12 hours just sitting on a bike, being in the heat, that will take its toll on you. And I sort of realized that if I wanted to make the most of my personal ability, then I needed to put more effort into actually maximizing the time that I had. And I did do, especially I only decided to do Mungo 4 weeks before because Lachlan Morton entered and I decided I would really like to race him, which unfortunately he never made it, but yeah, we can get into that. And so then I decided, okay, it's time to focus, you know. So I did do, you know, I did blocks where it was like 4 hours, 4 hours, 6 hours, 4 hours, four, you know, and then I'd have a rest day, so I mean 4 hours, 4 hours, 6 hours again. But I, actually, it was never 6 hours, more like 4 hours, 4 hours, 4 hours, rest day, 4 hours, 4 hours, 4 hours. Then I think I did 10 days out or so, I did a big, like 6.5 hour ride where sort of just tested myself and made sure, okay, I was in the place where I needed to be. And then I went into my taper and really just looked after myself and made sure that, I made sure I was fully recovered, very fresh, no like stress about, oh, I'm still feeling sleepy because I know I don't sleep the night before a race or the night before that either.
Mm. I mean, how did the race go for you then this year, as far as other additions that you've done, as far as personally how you felt, the conditions, you know, obviously we were all dot watching and got to see, it seemed quite close on the dots, but you never know what's actually happening out there.
No, it was definitely close. I mean, I think if I had to pick how I would have wanted a race to go, it went exactly the way that I wanted it to go. And sort of what I'd, the few people that I trust to say, okay, this is my plan. And this is like, if I do this, then it's going fine. So that they know not to stress, you know, my wife and a couple of close mates. And I said, well, the part that matters is after Sutherland, which is 800 Ks into the race, you know, so 350 Ks to go. And I was lucky enough that I left Sutherland with Brian, so we were leading. And I just had a lot more freshness in the second half, which had been, or the last third actually, which had been the goal from the moment I decided to do the race.
I have to interject that I had to bring this up. So there's a great photo your wife, Michaela, took during the event. We were obviously following on Instagram. And it's the one where he's sitting in the doorway, of, looks like the kitchen of a rural home, like the like some sort of love child between Tom Selleck and Bernard Hinault, staring off into the distance there. What, Chester, guy was phenomenal. Whereabouts was that in the race? Because it looked like you were at the 1,000-yard stare there.
Yeah, so that was at a place called Pampoenpoort, which is around 525 Ks into the race. It's at the end of what is the most interminable drag I've ever ridden. It's a 50K 1% drag. So it's not a climb, but it's never downhill. It's flat for a little bit, but it's middle of the day in the Karoo, and it's 40 degrees with a block headwind. So it's a particularly joyful place. And you've still got, after that, you've got 60 Ks to Loxton, which is a race village. On similar terrain, also into a block headwind. And I think like at that point, myself and Hansie Jaber had been sort of locked in a battle for 300 odd Ks there. You know, we'd been what you would call half wheeling on a normal group ride, but in an ultra race, it's like being 300 or 400 meters apart.
Yeah, what's that like? I was thinking about that. Like your miles, you're literally hundreds of kilometers from anywhere, and it's like you're riding like you're on a cafe or, you know, racing around the Cape Point or whatever.
Yeah. So I think you the one hard thing with Mungo, especially because it's like a middle distance race. You know, it's not 500 Ks, which is pretty fast, but it's not 3,000 Ks. So it's still really fast. I mean, you know, you're riding fast the whole time, but you can also get little advantages all the time and work those and use those, and there is strategy. So, you know, you're always just trying to put pressure on the guy that you're riding with. You're always just trying to get a little advantage, whether it's in their head or working their legs a little bit more. And you're always trying to read them and watch their, well, personally, I'm always watching people's pedal stroke and, you know, watching half and they're drinking and eating and just taking those mental notes and so that you can have some awareness of how the guy you're riding with is doing. You know, notice when they stand up, are they like wasting that half a stroke where they just need to give their legs a little bit of a rest? So when you see that, you know, and when you're feeling good, you're always just trying to get that 20, 30 meters ahead in the hope that they will just like force themselves to chase back and waste those little bits of energy that eventually destroy you.
Adds up at the end, doesn't it?
Yeah. Because I mean, you've only got so much in you. So yeah, I mean, that at that particular moment at that border stop, you know, this fantastic farming family, you know, it's a game farm. I've never really seen that much of the game because we're sort of on the outside of it. But the lady who runs it and her daughters, you know, they open their home, and obviously I've actually, just by the time I've been there, I've never met the farmer himself, because he's always out farming in the middle of the day. But, you know, they look after you and they make you sandwiches and bring you water, and really, it's fantastic hospitality. And it's actually like having been there now 6 times, you know, you greet them like they're your mates. But yeah, I was sitting there and just trying to work out, you know, Humphrey is very, very strong, and he won the year before. And I think it was a case of, it's been 40 degrees and you've been on the pedals for the last 2 hours, just trying to eke out and kind of trying to get myself mentally in the zone to do that for another 60 Ks. Because I knew that was...
Break that elastic, so to speak.
Yeah, I planned to sleep at the next race village, which was around 600 Ks. And I was adamant this year, I was not going to wait until I was tired to sleep. I wanted to sleep when I was good, because then I knew that I would recover and I would be fast.
And did that work out?
Oh, yeah, hugely for me. It was perfect strategy for my own riding. I mean, there've been other years and the other riders who might do better in other ways.
So when you did decide to sleep this year, you hadn't reached a point where you're like, oh my goodness, I need to sleep. You're like, you decided, okay, I'm going to be proactive with this rather than reactive.
Exactly, putting fuel in the tank before it's empty. You know, so I knew those next 60 Ks, I could actually push myself quite a bit because I was going to give myself the opportunity to recover. And it's almost like you're getting ready for an interval, but you've already done 525 Ks. So you're quite tired to start with. It's a hell of a thing to think, okay, cool, now I'm going to average 23. And it sounds pathetic because 23 is not very fast, but it's a block headwind. It's all this slightly uphill stuff. Then there's a very technical bit, like through Karoo Fault, where you are literally twisting and turning, and you're getting, you know, the fan boss is hitting you on the legs, and you end up cut open and whatever. You know, I mean, not bad cut open, but you do get scratched because that fan boss is rock hard. You know, it sees water annually, not weekly. And yeah, so you're just sort of trying to get yourself in the zone for that. So yeah, that was kind of a turning point in the race too, because Hansi left there like 3 minutes after me, and because the roads are pretty much straight, and I mean, there's not a whole bunch of like bends, so you kind of always in each other's vision, or if you look back, you can see where a guy is. So I was always just trying to keep that time gap. You know, I didn't want to let him come back to me.
Yeah, you put that work in now, and then it was time to hold that.
Yeah, so. I mean, like, I literally think I took the opportunity. I think he might have been taking a pee or something like that. Like, and I bolted. But, like, you know, that little gap counts. And so, you know, I worked that, and it, for 40K, sort of held it. And then, in like, the last 20Ks before the race village, I managed to pull another 5 minutes. And then I felt like, you know, I saw when he came in, and I'd already eaten, and I was deciding to sleep. I had a feeling that he would push on and try and get a gap on me, you know, believing, and I may have tried to look more tired, but I mean, I was tired, so I don't have to try too hard. But you know, I believed he would try to push on, and he did, and I think that may have been his mistake, because I know he struggled to sleep thereafter.
Yeah, because I remember the dot watches, all of a sudden he seemed to drop back, didn't he, after at that point, and then you and Brian sort of went off.
Exactly. So Brian passed them first, and then I got to water, like two water points later, which is maybe 100 and what was that, like 840 k's, so no, 740 k's, so that's another 140 k's down the line, and he was sleeping. And then I kicked on, and then I caught Brian at 800 k's, and then Brian and I rode together. Well, actually, when I got to 800 k's, Brian was sleeping or trying to. So then, you know, it was only us, and the next guys were 60 k's back. So I was confident that they weren't coming back to us. They weren't moving yet. So they were 60 k's back and sleeping. We were in Sutherland at 800 odd k's, 810 k's, and so Brian was trying to sleep. So I said, well, I'm going to just recharge a little bit. So I've got another 30 minutes. And then when we got up and went, then Brian and I were together. And then that next bit, I tried to push on a little bit, but Brian came back to me on some descents. And then he pulled away from me down Oberg. He was on a full sus and I was on a Richard. So I had exactly zero expectation that I would even try to hold the wheel. I have no urge to crash off Oberg Pass. Because I don't know that someone will find you. You might just live there then. And then, yeah, we got to the bottom of Oberg and I could put the hammer down a bit, and I got back to Brian before the water point. And then, yeah, I tried to sort of like just get some water into me. I always struggle with my chest and lunga. There's so much headwind and so much dust, and it's just really bad for you. So you're coughing up bloody black balls. So I put some more Vicks on, and by chance, at that water point, they had ginger tea, and they gave me some ginger tea, and that was really good. Somehow that fixed my lungs a bit.
Wow. And then coming in, I mean, what time did you get in the end? It was nighttime finish, if I remember correctly.
I think like 9 p.m., 57 hours. So that's, yeah, just after 9. I finished at like 12 minutes past 9. I'd had a good 300 k's by myself at that stage. So I think I thought that I'd be quite emotional crossing the line, but I had all my happy moments in the last 50 k's, or maybe actually just before the last 50 k's, because the last 50 k's were straight into the Southeaster, which felt like brutal punishment. And, you know, you're suddenly struggling to keep a 20 k's an hour on relatively flat rolling roads.
And did you have any idea of where Brian was by that stage, or?
I knew at the last race village, which is 100 k's to go, that I had a big enough gap that something would have to go wrong for me to lose that. But then, you know, you don't know that nothing's going to go wrong. I respect Brian's riding ability, and I'm not going to just sit around and let him have a great ride and catch me. I kept the pressure on. I wouldn't say I went like 100%, because you don't want to go to 100%, because the line between 100% and 0% is very short. But you know, I kept the yes. pressure on myself and made sure I was keeping a good speed. But you know, just in case, you can flip and have a puncture at a funny moment, or break a wheel if you have a puncture. I mean, you just don't know. Anything, literally anything can happen. So you've got to respect who's behind you and respect what you're busy doing. And I think it's a lot easier to keep the pressure on than to try soft pedal. Like, you know, the minute you take your foot off the gas.
No, I'm sure. Yeah. But I mean, yeah, it's difficult to come back to that, I'm sure. You kind of need to find that close to your limits, but when you come away from that, getting back up to that level is difficult, isn't it? So you got to kind of find that balance.
Yeah, for sure. It's the same as, you know, when you stop, those first few minutes are really like, oh, yeah. I mean, and like, I try not to eat too much at the race villages, you know. I try to keep it very light. It's long enough, it's short enough that you can tap into your reserves and eat away at some body fat and whatever without really like risking too much. And I mean, it's hard enough to eat after 1,000 k's if the weather's good, but when it's hot like that, it's even worse. Your mouth just feels terrible. It's hard. So I sort of kept the pace. I knew where Brian was. I knew that I needed to keep going. And yeah, so I got to the finish with, I think, a 60K or so gap, which was reasonable.
So the strategy worked, as you said, it went to plan.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, I'm very grateful for that, because it's definitely not a given. I mean, I told someone at the race briefing that I could finish 15th for all I know. And I really meant that. I mean, you just don't know. And there's so many strong riders, and anyone can have their perfect day. I mean, I've been witness to multiple others having like really, really good races. So, and I mean, Brian and Dean, who finished third, you know, Dean and I have been racing since we were 15. You know, we came through the road ranks together. So I knew what he was capable of. And I think, yeah, I mean, it was his first ultra distance race, and for them came third, which is amazing. And you know, Brian's had a really good year. So you don't want to take that for granted. But it was lack of racing them. I mean, here we are. I'm 35, Brian's like 12, and Dean's also 35. But you know, like, South Africa has always had this weird thing where like endurance is for old people. Like, okay, old, it's a bit disrespectful, but like older. You know, it's always ultra distance riders or runners or whatever have been 40 plus. And
been around the block.
Yeah, you know, and there's been this mentality that, oh no, you have to earn your stripes. And like, you know, I was partially maybe lucky or just fell into it through a whole lot of things, where I did my first Munga at 30, and then I did Race to the Rock the next year. And so I started fairly young. But it's so great seeing more and more young guys. You know, the top 20 was littered with guys below 40. And I think that's really, really good to see, because I think we've got a huge amount of talent in this country, and there's some riders who I think, if given the exposure, would do really, really well on a global stage. I think it's a pity that it's so difficult to be South African and race overseas.
Well, I mean, I kind of wanted to kind of like dig into that a little bit. There's two parts to it. The first part I wanted to come back, we'll come back to after, is Lockie Morton and how he was meant to race and what they would have meant for the race personally and for the race. But also what you just say there now kind of reminded me of something that, you know, historically, as you say, South Africans in the road racing scene, at least, you know, the pro peloton, considering the cycling community and culture in South Africa, I often find it surprising, like, how do we not have more? But we know there's a lot of roadblocks, there's a lot of reasons for that. And where this gravel and ultra and all that seems to be opening things up worldwide, where you see people that ordinarily wouldn't get that exposure are now getting that exposure. And perhaps now listening to you say that, it could be that in for guys to get that exposure, to go out to these races, whether locally or overseas, and you know, show what they're capable of.
Yeah, for sure. I think, I mean, it's hugely expensive to go overseas. I mean, I've just been putting together a budget to go to Unbound Gravel, because I've got an entry for the XL. But you know, it's $100,000 process. You know, you're away from work for a month, plane tickets alone, and then $30,000, and then you've got accommodation and that and that. So it's not something that you can do. Well, for most people, it's not something that you can just do.
And that's assuming the race goes well as well, you know.
Exactly. So it's not something that for most guys, you cannot just put that on, like, pay for that yourself. You know, they're not a whole bunch of guys with $100,000 sitting to spend on a bike race. You know, but I mean, I think we've got incredible talent. I would, if I win the lottery, I promise I will pay for Matt Beers to go and race gravel in America for 3 months. You know, like, he will. If he was on Unbound, I would put money on him. I mean, I just think he's got so much talent, and I think it's just such a pity that he's. I don't know what his plans are this year, but I just think it's such a pity that he's not getting more international exposure.
Do you think that's changing though, that international exposure? Because I feel, and that's what, you know, going to Lockie, like, I think it would have, and you probably agree, it would be good, it would have been great for him to be in the race, of course, to race against someone, his ability, but also the exposure wise, you know, and same as the exposure he brought to the Epic, not that the Epic needed exposure, but to have someone like Lockie at the you know, at the Munga, to see like, this is what we have down here. And I do sense that the tide is starting to turn, as far as we know, you know, in our community here, gravel community in SA, more and more events popping up and more routes, you know, some of it's unsupported, but I think that's, you know, speaking to some people over in Europe, and they're saying, yeah, they would love to come and ride down here, and it's getting that exposure. So you could almost work from going, right, well, let's work with what we have. Let's do these races locally. And the exposure seems to be growing. And that maybe that can be the launch pad, so to speak.
For sure. And I think, so back to Lachlan Morton, I think if he had been at Munga, it would have been fantastic. It would have brought a huge audience to the race. I mean, the kind of lucky, really, that he had announced that he was going to do it, because that, and there was press releases. I mean, it was really last minute that he bailed. Or was told to bail. I don't feel like he was happy with that decision. So I think there were definitely more eyes on the race internationally than there would have been otherwise, just because people were aware of it and sort of popped in. But him being there, and to be honest, him being at Epic, he brings a very different audience to the traditional mountain bike guys, you know. And a guy like him, he's done a lot to advance riding for fun and riding for adventure in the mainstream space. You know, there are a lot of people who understand, or at least know, that long distance riding and adventure riding and self-supported racing exists because of him and what EF are doing. So,
and I guess he's relatable, isn't it? He brings that side. He's like, people, that's why he's such a following. People feel like, oh, he's the guy next door. I can chat to him. And a lot of that's through the way that Rafa films and the way it's portrayed, but it's also the way he gives, the way he rides. And it's funny, that was my next point here, you know. So Lockie rode with his Cape Epic partner, 25-year-old Kenneth Karaya. Yeah. And how I noticed right at the end of the Rafa film with about the Epic, how him and Kenneth have bought some land. And they're going to open a bicycle skills school in Kenya. And then I was listening to Ian Boswell recently on the Rouleur podcast, and then he did a race, the Kenyan Migration Gravel Race. And just this awareness, and it made me think how gravel really is. And we were talking about this just before we started recording there, about how gravel, out of all the disciplines, seems to be, because A, there's no official racing, well, it's changing, but the rules are quite broad, you know, whether you're baggies, lycra, flat pedals, drop bar, clip-in pedals, flat, whatever, it's a lot more open, which seems to create this platform for people to feel more comfortable to join. I don't know if that's what you think about that.
Yeah, I agree completely. I think, I mean, for me personally, that's when I bought a gravel bike back in 2014, back when 32 mil tires meant it was a gravel bike, and we still rode tubes. It's so weird, but you know, I mean, now I fucking ride the same routes on 40 mil tires, and I'm like, oh, 45 should be right. It's weird, but that was it. I mean, even for me back then, you know, I was sort of, had finally come to terms with the fact that I was never going to be a world tour roadie, and yeah, you know, you're kind of looking for something that's a little bit more relaxed and a little bit, you can create your own space. And I think that's what gravel is on an international level. I think outside of racing, you know, these new, more corporate races that are popping up, that's definitely what it is in South Africa. I mean, if you go, you know, on a ride with a whole bunch of guys who have bought gravel bikes, they actually all just want to ride. They're not, the vast majority of gravel bike owners aren't buying them to race. They may race them, but that is not the first point of call in their purchasing decision. And so I think it is far more inclusive, far more welcoming. It takes away a whole lot of barriers to entry. It reduces a whole lot of fear, because, you know, there's no, well, no one can actually say what gravel is, you know. So what gravel is for me and for you and for, you know, some other people will be different, you know. And I think that's fantastic, because, I mean, I remember when I started riding, way back when I was a teenager, riding was just freedom for me, you know. It was just a way to get out and see places. And I think unfortunately, racing take like traditional racing takes away from that because you're so laser focused on performance, really. And
there's such a structure as well, isn't it, to how you have to act and ride and
yeah, for sure. And who you have to be, and like what length your shorts have to be, and you know how sharp your tan lines are, and how much you weigh, and what you look like, and like I wish that I had this image of cycling, not when I was a kid, but you know when I was in my 20s, because I think the old school road mentality of how skinny can you be, how much can you hate your life, how like you can't be having fun,
how much can you suffer,
yeah, like that's silly, you know. Why would this glorification of suffering without enjoyment is a huge like barrier, you know.
What do you think locally, what do you think there's a way forward, what would be the way forward? And we talk internationally, but we're obviously here in South Africa. What you know, I often sit and go, okay, what a way that we can sort of encourage people and get people. Is it just having these group rides, doing these weekends away, these kind of...
I think the real key is just to be welcoming. You know, we need to create a culture as riders where when we see a new rider or a person we haven't met before, they might be an old rider, but we haven't met them before. We don't make them feel silly for their clothes, their fitness level, their body shape, how they like to ride, what they think is cool, you know, where we go, well, that's rad. Oh, Tom over there, he likes wearing 1990s team kit and riding that type of bike. Like, I think that's fine.
I like Tom. Tom sounds great.
Yeah. But that's, I think that this, like the Illuminati rule or Illuminati, whatever, it's like the dumbest thing that's ever existed.
I've often thought that. I was like, I want to wear pro kit. Like, I want to wear, like you wear a football jersey or a rugby jersey. Like, so what? It's like, I love EF. I love the way they ride. I love the way they operate. It's like, you know, but you wear, and I remember, I was in Girona and they happened to be EF riders there. And I was like, can you imagine if just old Charles over here pops his EF jersey? Like, it would just be, oh, what a try hard. And I was like, that's so sad, you know, to go that's that automatic judgment.
It is, because if you're a Sharks rugby fan, you buy a Sharks rugby jersey. I mean, if you're a Matt Beers fan, shouldn't you buy a NAD jersey or a Top Dev jersey? You know, like, isn't that what sponsors need and want? Is that brand identification and that brand awareness? But I mean, that's a whole other kettle of fish. I think that racing has become a little bit restrictive and expect a certain way of being for people where, and it's been glorified by how hard things are, how difficult, you know, us as South Africans, you know, you've got the Cape Epic, which is the world's toughest mountain bike race. You've got the Mungo, which markets itself as the toughest race on earth. You know, everything is like how difficult, I mean, even if you look at other sports, you've got Comrades, you know, which is the hardest ultra marathon. You know, it's actually okay just to have fun. And you can, like, there's no reason you can't do the Mungo and have fun. I'm very proud of the fact that I will still be making bad jokes 1,000 km into a bike race. I didn't do that 5 years ago. My mentality has definitely changed. And that's credit to friends and my wife, and like, it changed my personal attitude.
I suppose that's when you're starting to get the full benefit of cycling, isn't it? When you're able to, the fitness, but the mental side is a big part of it. And you're actually able to then take that over to your real life, because you only ride for a couple hours. But then when you're able to take those sort of lessons and experiences, transfer it to every day, that's when you really see the benefit.
Precisely. And I mean, we all ride to feel better. So if you're not actually enjoying your ride because you feel like you can't stop to look at the view, but you want to stop to look at the view, but people say you shouldn't, you know, what's the point? You know, so stop, look at that view, you know, And yeah, I mean, maybe there are rides where like you're very laser focused on like an interval or whatever. But, you know, when you finish your intervals, go for a coffee, you know, and talk to your mates and have fun. And I think all of those things are important because you won't even be that good at going fast if you're not having fun on the other 4 days of the week where you're not going fast. So yeah, all that stuff matters. And I think that's where gravel with its, it doesn't have, I mean, obviously the UCI and CSA and whatever, they want to regulate it now and they want to have their sort of fingers in the pie. But, you know, on a general scale, you know, like right now we've got Sedgefield 500 going on down in the Cape. And that's just people going for a bike ride. Like the fact someone's going to finish first and that's nice. But it's still just 20 or whatever people. I once rode halfway across Australia so that I could get a high five and a beer. And you know, I might have done it at that stage slightly for the Instagram likes, but I think that's important. I hope that there will be a stage where the top talents, you know, the Matt Beers, and I mean, I was very fortunate at Munga. There was great prize money. Well, there is great prize money. But I don't think that, well, I know that didn't drive my decision to do the race or to be my best. And, you know, I've been lucky enough to meet people along the way, you know, from all walks of life and from South Africa and Australia and all over this country and others who've sort of shown me that you can just make it your own. And I hope that people coming into the sport and coming into this angle of the sports especially see that, and that we as cyclists who've been around for a longer period of time welcome those people and don't make them feel like if they're going on the group ride on a Friday morning that they have to have the latest gear, because that's just another barrier to entry. And cycling has got a million barriers to entry, you know, from wearing cleats to, you know, just how bloody expensive it is. Everything is a barrier to entry. So if we can just let people ride their bikes and have fun, and let, as long as they're having fun, then they're doing it right, then I think we'll get into a good place in this country. I think it's very important that we just let people have fun and encourage that.
Yeah, and I think, sorry, and that was, you know, I wanted to talk about that. It's something that you have your racing and that side, but the other side, which probably takes up more of your time, is your business Benki Rides, which I think ties in a lot to what you've just said about that community, getting people out there riding, enjoying. I was doing some research into that, and I happened to pop onto LinkedIn there. And I love the title, owner, head curator of experiences, bike build, spreadsheet manager, and chief tester of ice creams. I think critical skills to have in that particular field. So tell us a little bit more about, I mean, a lot of the local listeners will know Benki Rides and, you know, the experiences you do, but it's like, give us a rundown of what that's about.
Yeah, so when I left my more corporate job in cycling, I wasn't really know what the hell I was going to do with myself. So, I mean, I like going on bike rides. So I figured, well, maybe people want to come with me. And I was lucky that they did. And I mean, it's definitely evolved over time. My goal in the beginning, I can't really remember what I was trying to create as far as an experience goes, but definitely now, you know, just try to get people to ride in places that they wouldn't otherwise without the fear of, you know, try to remove some of those barriers. You know, I mean, going riding through the rural areas of KZN, for example, is quite intimidating if you've never been there. So try to remove some of those barriers to entry, and then just, I want to say, like, curate, because you don't want to force people into a certain experience, but give people the freedom to mold that particular experience into a way that's fun for them. And, you know, it's gone. I've posted everything from Cape Epic training camps to, you know, what would have been a golf tour in the past and is now a cycling tour, where Oaks get quite pissed every night, and pretty much everything in between.
Suffer on the bike the next day.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the guy's like 30 k's of riding, 9 hours of drinking, you know. And I mean, that's not the experience I want, but they have a jewel, and they get to see new places and appreciate a new part of the country. And so, yeah, so that, I think those are the, you know, on the one side, it's to try and give people new experiences in places that they wouldn't visit otherwise, and to remove the barriers to that. And on the other side is to encourage people to explore South Africa. I don't necessarily have to take people on a tour to do that. I think that people, they get some confidence to do things from seeing other people doing those things. And so I think, and I hope, that just by seeing people on tour and going to these places, that people are encouraged to step a little bit outside of their normal comfort zone of bike riding and try and experience something new and different, even if it's just adding 20 k's onto their normal loop in an area that they've always wondered what it's like. You know, on the other side, I'm aware that through the racing I've done and the riding I've done, that there are people who, you know, will look to me for some level of guidance. I hope no one wants to be like me, but I hope that I can give people the confidence just to do what they enjoy. But, you know, just to see that it's okay at the end of a hot ride to stop and have an ice cream and, you know, chat to a local spaza shop owner who's bought you a Coke, even though you each speak about three words of each other's language. You know, you don't have, like, you know, you don't have to speak someone's language to communicate with them.
It's quite a rare thing this day, isn't it? People forget how to do that quite easily, especially with what's happened the last few years. And you go and take them in that. And I think, and that's what I've always thought about, you know, with Benki Rides and those, the experiences, is that you do offer that level of kind of a bit of comfort going, okay, well, he's been there. Besides the ability on the bike is going to those slightly known, unknown territories with someone who's been there. It does, they let their guards down a little bit more and allows them to enjoy it a bit more and, you know, absorb the atmosphere and the experience. And it's like a drug, isn't it? You do that, you're like, why have I not done this sooner?
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, I've always said I never want to take someone on the same tour twice. You know, once I've taken you there, I hope that people have the confidence to go try it themselves, and that I've imparted some of the skills I've learned around bikepacking and touring and so that people can go out there and do it themselves. And I get such joy at seeing people creating their own adventures with a bit more confidence. But yeah, the one thing I've learned racing and riding and touring in South Africa is that South Africans are incredibly welcome. And unfortunately, there are places that you should not go ride your bicycle, especially when it costs 200 grand like some do. But the vast majority of this country, you can walk in and beg for water and you will get a smile and cold water and people will just be welcoming. I mean, living in Natal and touring here, a lot of that touring is in places which would be considered to have great poverty. And you know, people who in our, you know, big city terms have nothing, and yet they're always so willing to give whatever they have, you know, and sure, if it's a spaza shop, you pay for it, but they will also walk 300 meters with a bucket to get you water and then 300 meters back with a 20 liter bucket of water so that you can have a drink, and they won't expect anything in return for that. And I think that's such an amazing thing, because we really forget that that's what people do and that's who we should all be. A lot of the barriers that we've either had put between us or have created ourselves would fall away if we just spoke to people and just greeted them with a little bit of respect. And so I'm very grateful that I've fallen into these experiences, and even more grateful that I've been able to give a few other people the same, you know, both locally and foreigners. You know, I think it's a the great thing taking a foreigner into a shebeen and folks to sit and have a beer and half communicate and see what South Africa really is about, because it gets a flipping negative rap.
Well, I'm sure you are aware of it, but very much the image that is portrayed through your, you know, whether it's social media, through Benki rides, like it is, that's exactly the image that is portrayed. It's one of like going out there, experiencing what South Africa has to offer, being open-minded, and it's inspiring, I think, for a lot of people. There's a growing amount of riders like yourself, I think, in South Africa that are passionate and want to show people like what we have here. It's amazing. You know, you just kind of put yourself in the position to experience it. And I think that's awesome.
For sure. You just, as my friend Jesse said, you just have to get off the couch.
I think that's a lot of food for thought for a lot of people to think about. I think I've probably taken up enough of your time there, mate. But just before we kind of wrap up there, I just would be interested to know 2022. You mentioned potential Unbound XL. Like any other plans you're able to tell us about, or rides or events?
Yeah, I mean Unbound. Obviously, well, right now it's taking up a lot of my mental energy, just trying to work out how to get there and the logistics. I mean, Emporia, Kansas is not the most accessible place on earth. So just trying to touch base with some friends. I mean, my best man now lives in America, and so hopefully, you know, he's in Atlanta, so fly in there, and then how you get to the race and finding accommodation. And yeah,
with the other 3,000 people that are trying to get into that same small space.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so I'm just trying to work out the logistics around that, and then, you know, so that's early June, and then once I work out those logistics, then I would add sort of the fluff around that. I think,
yes, sure,
the opportunity to go race internationally has been one that I've said that I want for a long time, so I don't want to waste it.
Yeah.
I want to go there with good legs and give myself an opportunity. It is a distance that suits me. So, and I'm lucky to ride a bike that is pretty good for that rougher terrain and the curve. And I would be doing myself a disservice if I didn't focus on it.
Which curve are you riding at the moment? So are you riding with the two?
For that, I would ride the Kevin, which is not named after me, I don't think.
By the way, the first time I ever came across that a couple of years back, I honestly was like, dude's got a bike named after him. He's doing well.
I think it was actually named after Kevin Spacey, but it can't be named after him anymore. So maybe I need to ask Jesse.
So the Kev, so that's the what, like, you're going to run 45s on there, 700 sort of thing, because it's...
Yeah, sort of 45. It's a proper gravel bike. I'll probably run 45s. It's pretty rough terrain there.
You want some strong sidewalls there, I think.
Yeah, exactly. You're not going to go with your lightweight tires that you'd roll out in Durbanville, for example. So that's one. And then, I mean, I absolutely loved Freedom Circus, which is a 700K race with like nearly 13,000 meters of climbing.
Where is that now?
It's in the lower Drakensberg, around, it starts just outside Underberg and goes past Matatiela. So basically traverses the lowlands of, well, I mean, they're lowlands, but you know, they're at a 1500 meter altitude. And you're just never riding a flat road. The Drakensberg. So it's part of the Freedom Challenge group of races. So I'd love to work that in. The timing, it's like a month before Unbound XL, and I don't want to destroy myself because, yeah, it's at least as hard as Manga. And that takes a lot of recovery time afterwards. And then, yeah, we'll see. I suppose I've got a Manga title to defend, so I'll put that in there. Definitely on the list. Probably the first year I'll say I'm going back. I'd love to go, you know, I mean, there are lots of local races. you know, there's one now at the end of this month off the Dorp, and there's the road 200 miler, and there's some stuff up Kraken side. There's some great riding, you know, Swartberg 100. But I'm not good at not making a race an A race. So, and then gravel, XL, the manga, and yeah, if by some miracle I can fit Silk Road Mountain Race into the equation, that would make me insanely happy. You know, that and Tour Divide are sort of the big life goals, to race and to try and compete in. I think those are, yeah, I mean, Silk Road just appeals to me on so many levels. You know, it's probably properly hard, high altitude, bad weather, just really tests all the skills.
It's kind of seen as the pinnacle, isn't it, really, in that sort of racing. It's just so alien, so brutal.
Exactly. And I mean, Race for the Rock, you know, that's the only truly self-supported race that I've done. Like, there's so little support that no one knows the race is happening.
Just remind us, so is that the one, the race, that's the Australian race, correct?
It's in Australia. It's Jesse Carlson's masterpiece.
Right.
So the year that I did it was 3,100 km from the most southwestern point of Australia to Ayers Rock.
A lot of straight roads, I imagine.
A lot of straight roads, a lot of sand, just brutally difficult. You know, huge distances between farms, 250 km, wow, where you've literally got no resupply. So that self-supported racing, like the truly, like, carry everything, no race villages, no checkpoints, no social media.
Well, it's funny you read, because I read again, doing some research for this, reading one of your quotes from the Race to the Rock and reading what you had to say and the experience from the mental side. I mean, that for us, you know, with the Gravel Junction, a big part of it is not just the gear. And all, as I said in the beginning, it's also about the storytelling and reading what you said there about questions that were answered that you didn't know you were even asking, you know, spending that amount of time on a bike, you learn some things.
You spend 12 days with yourself. Eventually you get to the deepest, darkest corners. I mean, I got married just after that race and engaged just before it. So, yeah, it was pretty good timing.
You knew exactly who you were.
Yeah, exactly. But I think that's the sort of stuff that appeals to me. I mean, I love the diversity that ultra distance has. You know, I mean, you've got manga where it's semi-supported, but it is. I mean, you've got a water point every 60 to 100 k, so very manageable. There's great race infrastructure, and you know there are lots of races overseas in that vein. Badlands, as you mentioned, is on that sort of list where you know you've got the checkpoints and you know what you're dealing with, and all the way to like a Tour Divide or a Race to the Rock where you know you really everyone starts and then there's nothing. There's nothing organized, and you just get yourself to, there's only a point A and a point B, and you have to get yourself to those. So I think, yeah, the long-term goal in my life is definitely, I dream of winning Tour Divide. Whether I'm capable of that or not is well, it sounds super arrogant just to say that, but.
No, I think you have to back yourself. Got to be in it to win it, right?
Yeah, it's hard. It's a long way to go for nothing. But yeah, so you'll see. I mean, I'd love to go to Spain. I mean, Badlands really, really appealed to me when I saw it this year.
Yeah, it looked pretty brutal. Like, see, that looks like a very hot race, which you seem to kind of thrive in. The other one we were talking about was the further series for the east, but now further Pyrenees, which is what 500 k's, but a lot of hiker bike, but also a lot of tar.
Exactly, it's like that is a very, very unique race because it's like a mountain bike race with lots of tar and lots of hiking. It's very confusing, but I mean, I'm from South Africa, so Freedom Challenge, it's impossible for that not to be on my list of races to do. I mean, that's obviously more mountain bikey. I'll probably try and frustrate the previous race riders by doing it on a rigid.
I was going to say, you're going to throw out the GMX or something on that and put on the big boys.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, I mean, I respect that race a lot. I know, you know, that's like a whole nother extreme when it comes to navigation, because it's map navigation. You know, there's no GPS. That's literally hard copy maps like the old days. And you know, so that's another race where, you know, it really interests me, and I'd love to give it a go. But I'm also very, very aware of the preparation and the time and the prep work that's required for a race like that. So I don't want to do it half-assed. So in a word, I don't know how many I'm doing. I'm bad.
Yeah, well, I mean, as you say, you got some pretty lofty goals there, which is awesome. And I think we'd all be absolutely stoked, yourself and a number of other South Africans, to get over to that international scene, because I think we'd surprise quite a few people over there, and I think the trend's heading in the right way for people going that way. So we'll obviously be what's the best way for people to kind of follow you and get hold of you, you know, Binky Rides, Instagram?
I think Instagram these days is probably the best way. Kevin Binky with a Y. That's probably the best way. People are not scared of my DMs.
Okay, well, I'll put it in the show notes anyway.
And yeah, and then Binky Rides also on Instagram. If you're looking for tours or curve or whatever it is, you know. And I think, I'm always, as you've seen for the last hour and 5 minutes, I'm always around for a chat. Love talking bikes. I love helping people find ways to enjoy their riding more. It's what I live for.
That's awesome, man. Well, that's hopefully with this, with these sorts of chats, is getting the message out there, getting more people on bikes, which at the end of the day, I think is what we're all about. So, man, I appreciate the time, man. Very much, very much appreciate it.
No, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, hopefully we get to cross paths at some stage. Might have to head up that way.
I've got a spare room. You're always welcome.
Awesome, man. Thanks so much. And we'll chat soon.
Thanks so much. Have a good one. Cheers, mate.
And there we go. The wonderful Mr. Kevin Benkenstein. Thank you so much to Kevin for joining us and imparting some pearls of wisdom and sharing some great stories. Wonderful to have that sort of insight, and to have someone like Kevin representing us out there on the road is awesome. Also, thank you to you, the listeners, for coming by and enjoying our first episode. Like a lot of firsts, it is a little bit raw, like a gravel road, I suppose. A little bit raw, a little bit crunchy. But like a good gravel road, we'll get past the corrugations and onto the smooth stuff soon. So thank you for the support. Please do give the show a follow. Give some feedback. We're on at The Gravel Junction on Instagram. Would love any comments, input, feedback. As I say, we're a community here. And the more interaction we have, the better that community will be. So until next time, let's be like Kevin's mate, Jesse. Let's get off the couch. Go for a ride.